Put my thing Log on
Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it. Well, I and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is MJ Network, and this is Fran Lewis, and I am here to host, and I am so excited because Jessica Fletcher is back. And boy, she is up to her neck in murder and everything. And the only one that can tell you more about it is the new person that took over. John Land is here at Murder in Red. Oh, my God. You're going to think twice about going to some clinics to get cured. Oh, my gosh. So good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. Thank you. It's publication day, so that you're the first person I've spoken to since the book officially published at midnight last night.
Well, you're the one that I gave the first 5 stars to this morning at 6 o'clock.
Well, now there's good news.
Yeah, well, hopefully Amazon will think it's wonderful too. But yeah, that's the truth. I did, and I posted it on my review site so everybody could read my brilliance and know how great this book is. And there's about 10 people that are hoping that I'll give it to them, and I said that's why there's Amazon. Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the very first scene was unique. It was different in this book. Why did you create the first scene as a reception for the former librarian who died? And tell us about Jean. That was different. You don't normally start your books like that, but that was really good.
No, and that's a great question. Jean O'Neill was a character who was never in the books, but appeared in a number of episodes, and she was a character in a wheelchair who was suffering from MS. The reason why she was in a wheelchair suffering from muscular sclerosis is because that was exactly what happened to the actress who played her. And that actress, whose name slips my mind right now, lost her job on another show because she could no longer physically handle it. Angela Lansbury was a friend of hers and offered her a role on Murder, She Wrote, the TV show, just so she could keep her medical benefits. That's the kind of person that Angela Lansbury was and the kind of control she exerted over the show. So I think opening with the death of Jean O'Neill in the present so many years after she was actually suffering from this, obviously she would have had a pension in Cabot Cove, and she becomes one of the patients at the clinic you just referenced. So what I did was, and it's a very astute observation, as all your observations always are. That's why we have so much fun when I come on your show. It was a homage not only to the TV show, but it was kind of a homage, a thank you to Angela Lansbury for being the person she was, who was the driving force behind Murder, She Wrote, but always there was a heart involved. It was why her association with the show is why so many great guest stars of the time all were lining up to appear on the show. And, of course, the fact that Jean O'Neill's character in the wiki, in the background, the lexicon of the TV series, had this medical issue, she became a natural to become our portal, one of the portals that gets us into Clifton Care Partners, the sinister private clinic that has opened up shop on the shores of Cabot Cove.
Cabot Cove, they really want to watch out. They really got to get some more security to surround it so nobody gets killed anymore, but that would kill it. People have to get killed. So sad.
It's a great point, and there's a very there's a review unlike yours, and I'd call it a positive review that's currently up on the New York Journal of Books by a very astute fan of Murder, She Wrote, who knows the TV series and the book series. And she loved the book, by the way. But what bothers her is what I'm doing to Cabot Cove, the fact that the population has swelled, the fact that it's become a kind of Hamptons in the North, the fact that the environment has evolved. There are a lot of readers of the series who do not like anything to change. But you know, whenever I come on your show, I talk about conflict. And I talk about how characters, the importance of creating conflict by showing characters interacting in their own environment. I think, and this came to me last night as I was reading this review in the New York Journal of Books, I think the people who have not enjoyed my take on Murder, She Wrote, the people who have not embraced what I want to do, what I'm doing with the series, are people who want nothing to change. Maybe that's the definition of a strict cozy. In my mind, the definition of a cozy is not about place. It's about people. The characters in this story never change. That's what makes it a cozy. They're ageless, and they're always consistent. Mort Metzger, Harry McGraw, Dr. Seth Hazlitt. Jessica's supporting cast. They remain consistent. But what evolves, and what I think, what I wanted to do with the series is give it a take that brings it into 2019. Towns like Cabot Cove don't exist anymore. They exist in our imaginations, and they exist in the past or in past books in this series. But the fact is, the coast has become a resource, an invaluable resource. People are flocking to live in places that are near the ocean. Floodplains be damned, right? So I think that what I'm doing is an accurate take in trying to get the series when you talk about Cabot Cove. Of course, your point references the fact that it's the murder capital of the world. More murders happen in Cabot Cove. And people criticize me for acknowledging, not criticize me, but they make note of the fact that I make note of that fact in the books, that that people in Cabot Cove joke about how many people get murdered there. But that also happened, and this is what I tell you. In one of Mort Metzger's early TV episodes, he was played brilliantly by Ron Massick. He says, "I've been here a year, and this is already my sixth murder." So this is not something that I created. This was something that was being done with the television show. And as you know, I have chosen to follow the style and mythos of the TV show far more than I'm following the books, because for every one person who's read a Murder, She Wrote book, there are probably 100 or 1,000 who have seen a TV, at least one episode of the TV show. So if you want to grow your audience, the way to grow it is not by looking for more readers of the books per se. It's trying to get more fans of the TV show. Oh, and by the way, there are new fans of the TV show because it still reruns all the time and is now available to stream on Amazon. So this is a fabulous – arguably, you know, I guess Gunsmoke would be up there too, but is Murder, She Wrote – I'll phrase this as a question for the people listening today and to you. Is Murder, She Wrote, everything considered, the most successful scripted TV drama in television history? I think you can make that argument.
Definitely. And to me, it's much better than Gunsmoke. I'm sorry. I can watch Gunsmoke and predict who's going to get shot and what's going to happen.
I was always a Bonanza fan. I never liked Gunsmoke growing up.
Yeah, well, Matt Dillon, you know, I could sort of tell what happens on a Western faster, but on Murder, She Wrote, it's like, oh, that's who did it? Oh, okay. It's like, oh, my God. I mean, it's like Columbo, you know, who did it before you even start. And that's amazing. But Jessica Fletcher, nobody's better than Jessica Fletcher.
The writers for Murder, She Wrote and Columbo overlapped. So if you want to talk about intelligent mystery and totally different reasons, the thing that made TV, made Murder, She Wrote great wasn't just Angela Lansbury. It was the fact that the vast majority of those mysteries were very, very well written and well crafted. Mm-hmm. They were great whodunits with tension and cliffhangers and suspense and all the things that a number of the things that I get criticized at times by some readers for incorporating into the books.
Well, that's what keeps me not bored, reading the book. People, you don't know what you're talking about. Okay, so here's another one of my wild questions. I got tons of them here.
Love it.
Now, Jessica and Mort, this is an Amos. Why does Jessica seem to have a different outlook when working with Mort than with Amos? And then when he gets upset with her, he calls her Mrs. Fletcher, and she doesn't like that.
Well, it's a couple things. Mort is a much more professional law enforcement officer. He's 20 years on the NYPD. Amos Tupper was kind of elected or appointed sheriff in Cabot Cove with not a lot of experience. He had come by way of being a bus driver. Before that, as you're going to find out, in A Time for Murder coming in November, we can talk about that later. He was also a detective in Appleton, Maine, where Jessica met her husband, Frank, where they raised Grady for a while, where she was a substitute English teacher in Appleton, Maine. So the idea, and the Mrs. Fletcher thing, well, that's a great and very astute question. Because one of the things I've been criticized the most for, and this is valid, that even in the TV shows, Mort Metzger never calls her Jessica. He always calls her Mrs. F or Mrs. Fletcher. And I took that criticism to heart, but I had already, for two books, I had already established that between their characters. Because in my mind, because they've known each other so long now, so much longer in any notion of either book time or real time, they're closer, and now they're on a first name basis. But I think that I think him calling her Mrs. F again, and her saying to him, "Do you have to? Why are you doing that? I mean, you haven't done that in years," is kind of poking a little bit of fun at myself. That I missed, that I changed something that maybe I shouldn't have changed, and it was too late to go back. So this is my compromise, you know, the fact that he's starting to do it again, because in my mind also, to me, the series has been resurrected in the sense that it is following much more the template of a TV show again than it did in the last bundle of books that Don Bain and his wife were responsible for.
Well, we have Seth Hazlitt, and we have the Clifton Clinic, and we have Jessica, and she sees Mimi Van Dorn, and she said there's something odd about when she sees her. What did they promise her? And why does Seth Hazlitt having a fit because he thinks he's losing patience to that? So we meet
again.
Mimi Van Dorn. Yeah, she's like odd. Something's not right to go there.
Right, and Mimi Van Dorn is a patient at the Clifton Care partner, the Clifton Partners Care Center, that's now located. And Mimi is diagnosed with is a diabetic, and she's being treated for that at the clinic. Now this clinic is dispensing medication that may or may not be legal. And in Mimi's case, many of these places are also doubling as rejuvenation centers, where you go there and they promise you you're going to get young again. And I think Mimi is one of these older people who is obsessed with looking young. And what she will do, she will go to no ends. That's her goal. And that's what she's really come to the clinic for. So Jessica, you know, part of the mystery of this is why she actually went to the clinic and what happened when she got there. You make a great point about Seth, and I'm so glad you did. The reason why that's a great point is, and this is also a matter of, it goes back to why I enjoy incorporating environmental conflict into these stories. And that is the fact that Seth's livelihood is being threatened. You mentioned it. He's losing patience. Mm-hmm. There's a conflict, again, that word. There is a conflict between him and Dr. Charles Clifton because he thinks Clifton is a quack. His patients are leaving him to go to this clinic and get these new drugs and new treatments that he can't provide. Things are changing in Cabot Cove because that's the thing about life. It changes. for better or for worse, but it changes. And it is disingenuous to the reader to expect that nothing would ever change anywhere except for the people. Because you know what, in real life, you know what, Fran, people really don't change. People who have great hearts have great hearts. So I think what I've done in this series is maintain the atmosphere and tone of a cozy in terms of the interpersonal relationships between the characters. At the same time, I've taken Murder in Red in particular and the series in general into 2019. What I recommend people do who don't like what I'm doing is look at the copyright in the book. The year is 2019. It's not 1985. It's not 1993 or 4 when the book series started. Writers, I believe, have an obligation, a responsibility to be true to the world of the books that they're creating. I didn't create Murder, She Wrote, but I've taken over the series. And I need to be true to the way the books would be written today and not try to write them the way they would be written if this were 1985 or, as I just said, 1993-94 when the series actually began in print, slightly overlapping the TV series, but maybe just for one season.
You don't want to do that because if you just write it the way someone else wrote it, then they'll say, well, if he's writing it that way, it didn't come out the right way. Then, you know, Donald Bain wrote it this way, so how could John Land write the same thing? You have to have your own unique style when you're picking up a new series. So, and to me, people set in their ways, it gets boring after a while. And to keep her in the 1980s would be saying that the world stopped and then the internet didn't happen and nothing happened. So I would disagree
with
what they
said.
That's
an excellent point. And I think that I think the vast majority of readers have embraced Jessica's reliance now and her knowledge of technology. She uses Uber. She has a cell phone. Is that so? Mm-hmm. Are those two things so dramatic in the fact that Jessica does not have a driver's license? And here's the thing, Fran. Here's the thing. By leaving her totally dependent on everyone else to drive her places, that's not Jessica Fletcher as I envision her. I do that a lot in the books where Harry or Seth or Mort, they go together. And that allows for interaction, interpersonal conflict. But it creates a little more fun because she's not doing stuff alone. But on the other hand, if I make her totally dependent on a bunch of men, I don't find that to be particularly contemporary either. I want to make Jessica Fletcher a creature of modern. I want to make her not just a creature, but a celebration of mature women today, mature single women, in this case, a widow. This is a rising demographic. And I've never talked about this. And you know I always talk about things I never talk about when I come on your show.
I know.
What I've never said before is that I want Jessica Fletcher to be a prototype, an example, a shining example of what a woman in her early 60s, maybe mid-60s, because that's what Jessica is perpetually, living on her own, still making, fending for herself. I want to make her strong. I want to make her independent. I want to make her perfectly, and I want to make her contemporary. I don't want to make her codependent on anyone. And I think that to an extent, it demeans her character. And it is not – Jessica, this is not your grandfather's society, your grandmother's 1984 or 1985. Everything was different back then. We're talking about 35 years ago. I mean, look at – and you just said it. Look at all the things that exist now. Cable television, you didn't even mention cable. You know, very few – not everyone had cable when the show was on the air. Some people still had a limited number of channels. Life is different now, and Jessica needs to reflect that, and she needs to be a modern woman while holding on to the values – and the approach she's always had. She needs to be someone who has the courage to go to her high school reunion. This is in A Time for Murder. Not a high school reunion, but a retirement party for a former teaching colleague. She's fine going alone. She doesn't need someone to escort her. She has that confidence. She has that strength of character, that inner strength. Her husband has passed away for a long time. She never remarried. She never had children. But she's a very strong woman.
She's so like me, it scares me. You see, I don't drive either, and when my Jeff can't take me somewhere, there's my friends at Greenberg. I call them and go like, can you take me where I have to go? And yeah, they're amazing. You have to be independent in this world, and making Jessica dependent on everyone else would not be Jessica Fletcher. And how would she be able to solve the murders if she said to call everybody and say, now what should I do next? I can't figure this out. That's not Jessica. No. So we've got Mimi and her illnesses, and he was treating her and everything that happened. Now she's at the hospital. What happens to her that she's in a coma? And why don't they realize that somebody killed her? That was so not nice. Really?
Well, I mean, it's a question of I think that when you're doing a mystery, and for me, the fact that I'm a thriller writer, what I tend to gravitate toward is the fact that the mystery is part of the story, is a big chunk of the story. The rest of the story is why the murder happened, because the murder doesn't happen in a vacuum. The difference, I'd say, and here's something else I've never really said before, I don't think the murders in my stories are as random as they sometimes are in other mysteries. And even in some of the great Jessica Fletcher episodes on the TV show, where they were moments frozen in time. For instance, Murder Takes the Bus, which to me was the greatest, which was arguably the greatest episode ever on the TV series, is about a bunch of strangers on a bus that get stuck at a diner when the road washes out, and they start and the passengers are murdered. You know, one dies and then and others are threatened. Well, none of that reflects anything bigger than someone who's on that bus, the secret that they're holding. What I've done is I've made the crimes less of passion and more of foresight, because they're connected to something bigger. Mimi has to die. She has to be murdered because she's a loose end. And if in what's really going on at the Clifton Clinic. So it's not just that she was murdered, that Jessica isn't trying only to find out who murdered her. She also needs to find out why. And that why, that added question, is what creates what has been called by a number of people now essentially a cozy thriller as opposed to a cozy mystery. The fact that there's something in the background going on that is driving the murders. Something beyond the murders is happening. There's a cover-up in this case, whether it could be a cover-up. It could be to protect the secret. Obviously, that's the same thing, but it might be about money. In this case, it's all those things. So what I try to do is take this series to the next level from an entertainment pop culture standpoint. Just because the series is now in its 49th book with Murder in Red doesn't mean I can't add suspense. You mentioned you couldn't put the book down. You stayed up reading it. I don't think there's anything wrong with cliffhanger chapter endings, with putting characters in danger, with putting Jessica's life in danger, because I think that adds to the story. And here's a key point. It raises the stakes of the action. It's not just about solving a murder in the case of this story. It's about if Jessica can get to the bottom of things, she will be saving more lives in the future, because she will be putting the villains out of business.
Well, now you just brought up another point that I did. I was on a show with R.G. Belsky, and we were talking about writing and stuff like that. I did very little of anything. I just listened, basically. They wanted to talk about my new book coming out on June 10th, but I'll tell you about that later. I'm very excited. Cliffhanger chapter writing, That was the thing. How do you know, we were talking about, how do you know when to end the chapter and begin the next chapter so it doesn't sound like you're beginning it 20 years later? So a cliffhanger chapter has to start, you know, says, oh my God, what's going to happen next? And then the next thing you know, it's like 20 years later. So how do you know when to end the chapter and start it? I know you do cliffhanger chapters, and I go like, is Jeffa going to make it? Is something going to happen?
You know,
what's going to happen?
That's such a typically great Fran Lewis question, and let me tell you why. Because when I write a thriller, when I'm writing a Caitlin Strong book, and I have a cliffhanger at the end of a chapter,
uh-huh.
We don't get back to that character for two or three chapters because the cliffhanger literally hangs in the air while I divert, while we cut to, like in a movie, another viewpoint, maybe two or three other viewpoints before we get back to the viewpoint with the cliffhanger. But in Murder, She Wrote, it's first person. Jessica is in every scene. She's narrating the entire story. So a cliffhanger that ends chapter three has to be picked up at the beginning of chapter four because the books proceed chronologically, and Jessica is the narrator. So how do I know when to end a chapter? Well, I think with my Caitlin Strong books, I have a lot. I have over around 100 very short chapters. That's what comprises the book. In the Murder, She Wrote books, I chose to write in a more traditional format where the chapters are longer and contain more scenes individually. So part of when to end a chapter is based on the fact that all the chapters in this book are about 2,500 words. So it's time to end a chapter when I'm about at that 10, 11, not, somewhere between 9 and 12 pages. I know I'm getting close to the end of the chapter. If I try to end it on page 5 or 6 after only 1,500 words, I'm not sticking to the formula or the structure that I've created. But from a story standpoint, a cliffhanger is a device that I think that my instinct, my intuitive storytelling nature is telling me we have a flat spot. We've hit, Jessica is no longer running, she's walking, metaphorically. That's when you need to throw something at the reader. Now, here's the problem with that. Sometimes when you do that, you throw yourself a twist you weren't expecting as a writer. So now you have to resolve something you didn't know was going to be in there, and it's like, oh my God! But it's kind of like reverse engineering, because now you have to figure out you're writing backwards. You've added the twist to the story, and now you've got to figure out how it happened. Because the point you're getting at is this. Everything functions as part of story, of keeping the reader turning the pages. Why is it that when people read Agatha Christie, they say, oh my God, I couldn't put it down. I couldn't stop turning the pages. I couldn't wait to find out what happens next. They don't necessarily say that about Murder, She Wrote, but those books are marketed the same way. Agatha Christie's books are marketed as cozies too. So why is Jessica being judged by a different set of standards than Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple? Little known fact, by the way. Before Angela Lansbury got the role of Jessica Fletcher, she played Miss Marple. I think it was in the Mirror. I'm not sure what story it was, but she played Jane Marple, the character on which Angela Lansbury's Jessica Fletcher was based, pretty much, was Miss Marple. She was an American creation a la Agatha Christie. And it was a brilliant idea to do that. But she had played both characters. But Miss Marple is much more, the pace and tone of the Miss Marple stories is closer to what I want to do than the tone of the more recent Murder, She Wrote books, which basically diverted from mystery. The mystery was an afterthought. The cozy atmosphere had, in my opinion, and I don't mean disrespect to my predecessor, but what I'm stating is a fact. We were the the books got too tied up in the minutia of Cabot Cove. While that's what some people want, it's not the way to grow a series or to improve a series or to make a series more appealing to a larger number of readers.
So I have another question here. I'm sitting here writing as you're talking. This is terrible, awful. There are a lot of people that are copying your series. I just want you to know. The Fiona Quinn series, I promised her I would say this, Cindy McDonald, because she ordered my new book on Kindle. And Saddle Up for Murder, she has a character that's trying to be Jessica Fletcher. She's really good, but nobody's Jessica Fletcher. Sorry, people. Doesn't going to happen. So we have Tripp. And she was talking to Tripp before this happened. And Jessica wants to know why she was talking to him and who is he. And then we know we have Charles Clifton. He's got about as much warmth as a dead ice cube, this guy. Really?
Well, Tripp is, now there's, we talked about cliffhangers, so this is a great segue.
Yeah.
I didn't know when I started the book there was going to be a quadriplegic character. I didn't know that quadriplegic character was going to turn out to be Mimi Van Doren's son living in a chronic care facility. I didn't know that Mimi had broken the trust that was paying for his health care, his medical upkeep. She had cashed in that trust to pay the Clifton Clinic the money they needed to get her in some clinical trial, which could make her younger. I didn't know any of those things. So those are the kind of – that's the way I write. I write organically. So Jessica goes to visit Tripp because he is the last person that Mimi talked to before she dies, or before the last phone call that Mimi got. What were they talking about? What did Tripp want from his mother, as it turns out? And of course, that's the thing. That was the cliffhanger at the end of a chapter. I'm Mimi Van Doren's son. Boom. Kick in the gut. Next chapter, we continue. The beginning of the next chapter continues their conversation. It doesn't obviously jump to another point of view because there are none. I think that in any mystery or thriller, there is a moment of connection when the story falls together. And I think for me, Tripp was that moment, even though it happens much earlier than it normally does. Because now you had a character who was harboring a secret. A character who is much more – Tripp's character is important for any number of reasons. Spoiler alert, the way everyone assumes he committed suicide. But Jessica notices something that no one else noticed. And it's a very simple clue. It was very obvious, but it was something that she noticed and had remarked about in an earlier scene with Tripp. So you have Tripp not only brings out the detective in Jessica, he also is what might even be called the catalyst. His involvement in the story and his murder about a third of the way through, maybe 40%, is what leads Jessica to realize something more is going on. It also gets us involved with a kind of noirish lawyer, Fred Cooper. And Fred, what is Fred Cooper's role in this? What is his connection between Tripp and Tripp's mother, who is Mimi Van Doren? And the other thing is that comes out, and again, this is my first interview, but this is probably something I'll never say again. I think the other thing this book does, and maybe in arguably non-cozy fashion, Mimi Van Doren is a very close friend of Jessica's. They play gin rummy together. They're buds, all right? They're besties. But in this book, Jessica realizes she didn't know Mimi Van Doren all that well at all. She didn't even know that Mimi had a son. Maybe because Mimi never spoke about her, maybe embarrassed over the fact that he's a cripple, a disabled, I shouldn't say cripple, bad word. But he's a quadriplegic. Maybe she's embarrassed. Why? So the fact is that Jessica doesn't know a close friend nearly as well as she thought she did. And isn't that the case in life? when people disappoint us, that people we thought we knew do something that makes us go, I thought I knew that person. How could they do that? And I think that leads Jessica to question herself in the sense that, you know, how could I not have seen this in her? Why did I accept everything at face value? You know, and part of the fun of this book is watching Jessica follow a trail that leads into a close friend's past. She goes to Marblehead. My favorite scenes in this book to write were the former chief of police in Marblehead, Mass. The only character who knows the truth of what's really going on has dementia. So when Jessica goes to visit him at a chronic care facility, she has to figure out, she has to read between his comments to try to string together the clues. It's like solving a riddle. And he's such a great character. And here is a wonderful compliment I got in a review that's going to pop today. A reviewer for BookTrib, Merrill Moss, which is put out by a great publicist company, Merrill Moss Media, BookTrib, wonderful journal of reviews and coverage of writers, said how great it was that Jessica, has this, notices things that no one else can notice, and that BookTrib were the people who gave was the review site that gave birth to the term cozy thriller.
Well, you have to read my review, but my mom had Alzheimer's. And as I was listening to him, with this man, it reminded me, he was more lucid than my mother was, to tell you the truth. Alzheimer's dementia is a deadly disease. It's worse than any fatal disease ever. So I was like, yeah, this is great because these people understand. Now we have this drug, which is not a real drug, is it? Benzapan. Because I looked it up to see if I could figure out what it was. And this is the drug that they were giving everybody at this clinic, right? And
not everybody, but
regenerative medicine. So this is supposed to make her look younger. And, you know, I looked it up and I'm going like, maybe, you know, everybody should take this. Maybe I'll look younger too. You don't know. Then when I figured out what happened, I go, I don't think so. So how did you come
up
with that?
But it's based on a real drug.
That's what
Benzapan is a fictional version of a cancer drug that is now under clinical trials that is being tested for its ability to rejuvenate cells. If you rejuvenate cells, you retard the aging process. So this is actually based on fact. I didn't make it up. It actually exists. And the thing is, though, it's not approved for this use. And if it's not approved for this use, and Clifton Care is claiming that it's part of a clinical trial, but they don't have any clinical trials, according to the FDA, it's being dispensed illegally. It's being dispensed. And the other thing we get into in this, and this is something I'm glad you raised that issue, because the other thing this book gets into is pay-for-play medicine, where you get into a clinical trial because you pay to get into a clinical trial. Sometimes that amount is six figures. This is also true. There are stem cell and other kinds of clinical trials out there that you have to pay to get into. So the idea that someone is paying six-figure and even seven-figure amounts of money to a private clinic for drugs they couldn't get anywhere else and treatments they couldn't get anywhere else for rejuvenation. This is already happening in Europe. People go to Europe for these things because they can't get them in America. So the idea behind, and this is where I was getting at BookTrib before, and they said one of the things they said was it's the best last page they'd ever read. And when you read the last page, it ties in with that police chief who has dementia, but it also ties the entire mystery and book together. I took that as a great compliment. But the other thing that a lot of the coverage of this book and others have said is that that's what makes them thrillers. This isn't just a mystery about someone who dies because someone has to cover something up. There's also a larger story happening again in the background that has to do with that's basically a multi-million-dollar scam. Clifton Care Partners is going to have multiple locations all over the country. This is just the first. Others are being built, and this is obviously something that's nefarious. It's obvious almost from the beginning, as it is in any mystery, that these are not nice people running this clinic. The fun lies not in determining that fact. The fun lies in watching how Jessica Fletcher nails them and brings them down. And there's what makes – there's the twofer. It's not just solving a mystery. It's bringing down the bad guys behind it. That's where we come up with the phrase cozy thriller, because we take it to another level. Instead of a one-off, a mystery that's solved, it's a mystery that's solved that prevents other lives from being lost. That's what I strive to do. Now, that's true of this book. In the next book, A Time for Murder, the 50th book in the series, in which we will meet Jessica for the first time as a young woman, it's much more of a classic mystery, both in the present and the past. The fun lies in connecting the two. So I guess what I'm saying is that, again, you're getting something I've never said before. When I write any book, whether it be Caitlin Strong, but especially in Murder, She Wrote, because it's such a great brand, how do I define what makes the books fun to read? How do I define for readers in the course of the writing and the creation of the story why they're not going to be able to put the story down? And in every book I've done, I've now done four in the series. Murder in Red is the third. A Time for Murder in November is the fourth, but it's finished. In every one of the books, there is a different reason. There are different factors that make them fun to read. And each, so they don't they follow a formula, but in each book, that formula takes on a different shape. It takes on a different color. It takes on a different tone. So each book that I've done so far feels let me put it this way. What Jack Warner once said about what he wants in his next movie: give me the same thing, only different.
Well, I've got a couple of thousand more questions, but we have 17 minutes, but I have to announce on Tuesday, June starts, and why not start it with Swans Down in Charles Salzburg? And on the 6th, I am honored, because I don't know if he does a lot of interviews, David R. Dow, Confessions of an Innocent Man. He runs the Texas Innocent Network dealing with, he's adverse to the death penalty. And the book is really fantastic. On the 10th, we've got Gabriel Vajon, The Naming Game. And that's the day that Silent Voices, my book, is coming out, that day in print. My new Spaces Behind the Stone series, told from the point of view of anybody that's dead behind the gravestone. Wait till you read this. It's really good. On 6/12, we have the person that gave me the blurb for the front cover, Vincent Zandri, and the caregiver's wife. And then we have the 17th. We have a panel. We're going to talk about author and Hollywood, and five authors are coming on to talk about what happens when you sell your script. And on the 19th, you're going to be on this panel with Alan Topol, Philip Margolin, and R.G. Belsky. We're going to talk about strong female characters. And that's just some of what this girl's up to in June. I end with the 24th with Murmur of Bees, and the 27th, Emily Eternal. And I go back on August 6th with, if you haven't read it, and you haven't pre-ordered it, The Dead Girl in 2A by Carter Wilson. By far is absolutely scary and one of the best of 2019 besides Murder, She Wrote. So now we have to bring in somebody else because we have a few more minutes. You got to talk about George Sutherland and his relationship with Jessica. And he is in the Clifton Clinic too, isn't he?
He is, and for those who don't know George Sutherland, he is a creature. Now, this is a diversion for me, because George Sutherland is a creature of the books and not the and not the TV show. But I wanted to do something for fans of the books. And I also wanted to ratchet up the stakes of the story. So I was able to meld the two. I was able to bring back a favorite character who hasn't appeared in a while for the book fans. But I didn't just do it like and stuck him in and threw him in and say, I'm just going to do this because people will be happy. I did it because the fact that he's there, he's at the Clifton Clinic being treated for something, means that he's sick. This is Jessica's one romantic interest since her husband Frank passed away. This is the one man she's ever been romantically inclined toward, has, quote, dated. And, of course, they've solved mysteries together. That goes without saying. But his presence in Cabot Cove is crucial from an emotional standpoint because it rekindles Jessica's feelings for him.
Mm-hmm.
But it also adds suspense to the story because it raises the stakes because now he is a potential victim of the sinister Clifton Care Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And if Jessica doesn't get to the bottom of what's going on, someone she's very close to and has feelings toward may be the next victim.
That's just scary. So now you bring another character. I wish he was still alive, Jerry Orbach, because I love him as Harry McGraw.
Oh,
McGraw.
wonderful actor.
I watched Murder, She Wrote, and it's not the same without him in Belzer. So how come she employs Harry McGraw, and how come he goes to all these places? He doesn't even ask. He just goes, whatever she says. All right. She drags him all over the place. I love that character. I love Harry McGraw.
Their dialogue, I have no idea where it comes from. It's just so natural and so like the TV show. He's a rumpled, old-fashioned private eye, self-deprecating, you know, always putting himself down, but always looking out after Jessica's best interest. And the thing is, when you write a first-person book, and this ties in with what we've been talking about, but why is he in the book? Because there's only one viewpoint to Murder and Red and all the Murder, She Wrote books, because Jessica is the lone narrator. She has the sole point of view. So to create tonal, to change the tone, to change the pace, to change the feel so it's not repetitive and dull, who she interacts with, and that's the key, her interactions with Mort, Seth Hazlitt, and Harry McGraw come to define the flow and pace of the book and continue to define them as cozies because they're doing the same things they always do and the relationships are the same. But Jerry Orbach's character of Harry McGraw, of course, I picture him as Jerry Orbach too, is also crucial because he is a brilliant detective. And he's always able to find things out that other people can't. So Jessica, because she doesn't drive, she can't get everywhere, sometimes she needs to make a call and ask Harry to check something out for her. But of course he gets more involved than that. He shows up and becomes her driver and gives her a sounding board where they can discuss the clues that Jessica has realized. The classic cliffhanger in this book is when Jessica realizes something, but I don't tell you what it was. And I don't, you know, it's like the last line of the chapter is, and then she realized. But I don't reveal it at the beginning of the next chapter. I wait a little bit. So that's the kind of role that Harry McGraw plays. He might leave Jessica a message and say, you know, again, cliffhanger, Jessica, I found the answer. Call me back right away. Something like that. So he's the he is Jessica's go-to guy, basically.
Well, before I end, we've got about 10 minutes. She meets Fred Cooper. I know I didn't like him at all. I'm sorry. And he was very hostile to our Jessica. And Jessica did a Fran Lewis. She let him know she was in charge, and she was very brazen and blunt and doesn't tolerate anything, which is definitely me. So why doesn't he like poor Jessica? And with Mimi, there was something related to the trust with him too, right? She said, with Mimi to steal money she set aside for his trust, something about him is odd, this Fred Cooper. How come I don't like him? I don't trust him.
Well, he's snide. He's oily in all the right ways. You know, I guess since I'm slamming doctors so much in this book,
yeah, me
little,
too.
You know, maybe I'm slamming. You know, let's do equal partnership with slamming a lawyer at least. People resent Jessica when they have something to hide, because they know she's on to them. Just like you mentioned Columbo earlier. How many times
yeah.
a year, oh, just one more thing, and the person looks at them, rolls their eyes, and goes, yes, Lieutenant, what is it? People tolerate people who have nothing to hide love Jessica. People who are hiding something they're afraid she's going to reveal are basically threatened by Jessica and respond in kind. Fred Cooper knows that Jessica's on to him and knows that he's going to get caught. And I think initially he tries to be cooperative, but it becomes clear that Jessica knows things about him or has figured stuff out, that she's got him in her crosshairs, metaphorically, figuratively.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows that. It's a cat and mouse game, as all great mysteries are. And how is Fred Cooper involved in the mystery? Why is it he knows, why does he know both Tripp and Mimi? He can't represent both. But he never told Tripp that he was representing Mimi, and that he wouldn't represent Tripp. Something is going on. He's hiding something, and finding out what becomes a key clue in the mystery.
Well, before I end this, this is another one of my wild questions. Okay, Mort got me very upset because he wanted to arrest Jessica to keep her out of trouble for herself because she never gives up. So Mort and Jessica, are they going to come to blows one of these days? Where they just like, he's going to just say, I don't want you around, or like, you can't help me, or whatever? Is it going to come to that? Because he got really angry with her in this one.
I think that he gets angry that because he likes her so much now, after all the years they've been working together, that when she puts herself in danger, when she shows up someplace alone, when she doesn't tell him what she's up to, he gets angry. But there's a lightness to their exchanges. He never meant he was going to put her in jail to prevent a murder instead of arrest a murder.
Yeah.
It's what he says out of frustration for the fact that she can't let go of an investigation. Jessica is relentless. Jessica, as you know, and I just think back to the great episodes of the Murder She Wrote on television. She's always relentless, and oftentimes she's relentless because it's a nephew, it's a niece, it's a trusted friend.
Yeah.
It's someone who's been falsely accused or is embroiled in a mystery or has become a victim of a murderer. So Jessica is relentless in her pursuit of bringing the bad guys to justice. And that is what I brought back from what I feel. And I've watched a lot of episodes to get the right tone. And believe me, that is the right tone. Whether or not it's present in the previous books to the same degree I'm doing it, not really. But I'm going back to what I loved about the TV show.
Well, let me give you one last question on my page of 10,000.
We still
here.
Have 8 minutes, so we might have time.
I know. I've got a whole bunch of questions. Don't worry. I got plenty of them. When the pieces come together and the final revelation is revealed and she learns about Mimi, how is she going to handle the lies, betrayals, and deceptions that she called a friend? So if Mimi lived and had to face Jessica after what she finds out, would they remain friends?
That is a great question. And the answer is, I think the answer is probably yes. And the reason is this. Mimi held back secrets from her past. And I think we're all allowed to have a private life. We're all allowed to have a personal life. And I think the problem with this 24/7 news cycle, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all these things, people's privacy is forever being threatened. And
yep, I know.
Jessica, friendships are often based in the moment. You get to know someone not based on who they are, especially when you meet them later in life. You don't know who they were before. You know, Jessica and Mimi are very close, but they've only known each other about 10 years, almost exactly 10 years. Jessica didn't know Mimi before those 10 years. So their relationship is based on the now, not on what happened before. So I think that Jessica would be disappointed in some of Mimi's actions. But the fact that Mimi had withheld secrets about her own private life, I don't think would bother Jessica all that much. I think Jessica is also a private person and doesn't necessarily want everyone to know everything about her. So, yeah, I think they would still be friends.
Okay, now what about George? Is he coming back again?
Good question. And you know, I don't think that far ahead. You know, I think that
I like him.
He's a great character, but he's not. But we're going to find out other things about him in the story and his purpose in Cabot Cove and what he's doing there. But he, to me, what George does in this book is he highlights a part of Jessica we haven't seen in a long time on the TV shows. The fact that her feelings for him, her worries about him, it makes Jessica a completely well-rounded woman in the sense that it's not that she's more vulnerable or weaker. It's that we see that she can honestly care deeply and not just out of compassion and friendship, but out of love for another person, that she's capable of not moving on from Frank, but moving away from Frank's memory. She's not sure herself what she wants with George, and that makes her feel like you and I. We don't always know what we want from a relationship or from life. We're not sure. So I kind of think that George's presence in the book highlights any number of features of Jessica's character and makes her an even more fulfilled, and complete heroine. A complete hero.
Well, the ending of the book was really, really interesting. And they go back and they honor Jean again, right? They do that. That was really
good.
They do.
It wraps up. The last two books, this one and the next one, that's not out yet, both climax or finish kind of the epilogue in Mara's Luncheonette. When the whole gang is together, Harry, Seth, Mort, they're all there. I have fun with that. But before then, of course, the climax is action-oriented. Jessica is, you know, she's forced to do things physically. She hasn't done in a lot of books before. So I think that you need a kind of coming back down to earth. Let's resettle ourselves in a comfortable place. Let's take the book back to where it started with friends gathering. To cushion the fact that Jessica's life was threatened and that she almost died in the last chapter.
I know, and that would have killed the whole series. You can't kill off the main character. You can't
off Moit. Arthur Conan Doyle did that when he tried to with Sherlock Holmes, and the Queen insisted he bring him back to life. You know, there were only a handful of Sherlock Holmes novels, the great bulk of the stories were short stories. Novel is very, very short. You know, not even close. That's what makes it's so humbling to be doing the Murder, She Wrote series when you think the 50th book is going to come out in 6 months. This is the 49th book in the series.
My reading students love Sherlock Holmes, and I work with kids with learning disabilities, but I was able to find a book that was written on a lower level, and they loved it, and they loved acting them out. And they love learning about Sherlock Holmes. And these were tough fifth graders and sixth graders. And they said, oh, my God, this is like the greatest thing. They thought Sherlock Holmes, they read Agatha Christie. And I made them read everything. But I made them read my favorite book in the whole universe, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Oh, and Robert Louis Stevenson.
Not only did they love it, but guess who came in with a red liquid and drank it to show them what happened when he was drinking the liquid? And I acted out the scene. And I even put on a mask to be Mr. Hyde. I scared the daylights out of them. It was so cool. You know, you never knew what I was going to do. So
when Lon Chaney Chaney played him for the first time in silent films, he did it without makeup. He did it entirely by transforming his character without changing his appearance. So that's the brilliance of acting. You know, Lon Chaney did the same thing. You know, Phantom of the Opera. He was the original Phantom of the Opera. So, you know, he cut his teeth. That was acting.
So where can we learn more about you and your work, and when am I getting something? And Tara's very good, and she reminds me all the time, and I remind her all the time. And she sent me something else. She sent me something else to read. How nice is that?
Murder. Relationships are great. A Time for Murder. I should have the ARCs, the galleys. The print galleys are a little take about an extra 6 weeks, but I should have the digital galley any day. It would maybe within 3 or 4 weeks. So A Time for Murder will be in circulation soon. And if you want people want to learn more about Murder in Red, you know, read the reviews on, you know, go on the internet and Google it. See what people are saying about it and make your own decision whether it's a book you want to read. I always advise against going to authors' websites because you're not going to get an objective opinion about what, you know, you'll find out what's coming out next, but you want to find out if you don't know much about me or about the book. Just do your homework or trust me that you won't be able to put it down and you'll have a great time for a few hours of great reading entertainment.
Well, go on Just Reviews. I posted it at 6 o'clock this morning on my site.
There you go.
And
that's where to go to find out about the book.
I have to tell you, everybody reads what I write. I mean, I think I posted it at 6 and about 6:01. Somebody liked it. Somebody else liked it. It's scary. People read everything. And I was honored that not only did Vincent Zandri, but Nancy Allen and Carla Negus all read the promo for my new book. I was really honored that anybody read it. And it's scary. It's coming out June 10th. It's Silent Voices, and it's a Faces Behind the Stone series, and it's told from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone. But if you didn't read Murder in Red and you want to know more, go on Just Reviews and go on Amazon. And if Amazon doesn't tell me that they love my review, I'm going to scream because I put that on at 6 o'clock this morning, too, with my 5 stars. Seriously. And you will be on my panel, right, on June 19th?
I will.
Female character. That I'm excited. It should be interesting because Philip Margolin is going to be on that one, too. That should be really interesting. And R.G. Belsky and Alan Topol. So everybody, it's raining outside, but don't worry about it. Pick up a book and read because you're going to love this one. And like I said, there are a lot of people that have asked me for this, but that's why we have Amazon and Kindle. Get it yourself, because I'm keeping this one on my shelf. And I can't wait to read the next one. When is Caitlin Strong coming out again, so I know when I'm ready for that one?
1 year, 11 months from now, Caitlin will return in Strong from the Heart.
I can't wait to read it. You know I can't wait to read it, because I love Caitlin Strong. Thank you so much, John. Everybody, have a great day, and bye.
All right. Thank you, Fran.